Today is Friday, June 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. French police continue protesting new restrictions following global demonstrations against police brutality.
They think that the French government made too many concessions to the protesters.
Plus, North Korea says it sees little use in maintaining close ties with U.S. President Donald Trump.
If Washington sticks to, quote, hostile policies.
And the psychology of Zooming in the age of COVID-19. We'll have those stories and more next. French police staged a protest on Paris's Champs-Élysées against restrictions on restraint holds they can use and curbs imposed by the government in response to public anger over cases of police brutality in France. It followed similar protests on Thursday when police threw their handcuffs and other equipment to the ground in protest. Earlier, I spoke with journalist Nicolas Pinault in Paris via WhatsApp to get the details.
Well, according to police unions here in France, you have a lot of confusion in the debate right now, and they're not really pleased by the decision by the French government. They're very upset by their interior affairs minister here in France, because basically to try to calm protesters down and to make sure that there's the zero tolerance policy within the French security forces. Basically, he banned several measures, and especially the chokeholds to detain suspects. And many police officers, they now think it's infeasible right now to arrest people, especially violent people, without this measure. On the other side, they think that the French government made too many concessions to the protesters. And one of the main measures also is that if there is racism, some racist acts within by a policeman, it should be suspended. And what they feel, what they claim, police unions, they claim that you're going to have several defamations against police officers who are just trying to make their job. So as of right now, it's very split, and you have kind of a bitter protest within the police unions, because basically they feel that they did not receive enough support from the government, and that we should not, you know, mix everything. What's happening in the U.S. should stay in the U.S.
It's interesting that you say that the police officers say this is a U.S. issue when these protests have cropped up across the world, where several countries are reflecting on their colonial past, toppling statues of individuals related to the slave trade. Can you further explain exactly what has been the reaction of those protesting against racial inequality to the remarks by the police department?
Well, basically, people here in France, and that's something also to give you some context. Here in France, we don't have a body camera. We don't have dash cam on police cars, for example. Okay, it's testing right now. I mean, you know, it's 2020, and we still don't have this kind of equipment on every police officer in France. So when there is some issue with some arrest, basically, it's the problem of the police officers against the position of the person who has been detained. And that's one of the main complaints right now. And in France, you have also this debate that any police officer can ask in the street for identification to anyone. And people, and it's been proven, people, non-white people, they claim that all the time they are the ones targeted to get IDs by the police in France. And obviously, they want this huge overhaul. You have this huge mistrust against the police officers and in general in France.
Nicolas Pinault is a reporter living and working in Paris, France. U.S. lawmakers this week remember the life of George Floyd, the black man who died while in police custody in Minneapolis, Minnesota on May 25th. Continuing nationwide protests over Floyd's death have kept the pressure on the U.S. Congress to address racial discrimination in American policing. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports on the possibilities of Democrats and Republicans finding common ground on this controversial issue.
George Floyd laid to rest. The nationwide protests over his death, a turning point, said lawmakers at his funeral.
George Floyd changed the world. And we're going to make the world know that he made a difference.
At a vigil for Floyd, calls for change in American law enforcement.
Making sure that policing turns away from being a warrior and the denial of civil liberties and civil rights and turns into a guardian, that its focus is public safety.
Floyd's brother marching in Washington after testifying to lawmakers considering a measure to reform the police.
The bill would make it easier for the federal government to successfully prosecute police misconduct cases. It would ban chokeholds. It would end racial and religious profiling. It would encourage prosecutions independent from local police.
The Democratic proposal is separate from protester calls to defund the police, but many lawmakers want to shift law enforcement funding away to other priorities. One such advocate, a leading contender to be Democratic nominee Joe Biden's vice presidential pick.
I support investing in communities so that they become more healthy and therefore more safe. Right now, what we're seeing in America is many cities spend over one-third of their entire city budget on policing.
The White House has already called one key Democrat proposal ending police protection from civil lawsuits a non-starter. In the Republican-majority U.S. Senate, the only African-American Republican senator is crafting a proposal and sees room for agreement.
There's common ground between the House bill, our bill, and the White House bill.
And even the U.S. Capitol could look different, as calls mount for taking down the statues memorializing generals and leaders of the slaveholding Confederacy that lost the U.S. Civil War.
Treason. They committed treason against the United States of America, and their statues are still here because their states put them here.
U.S. President Donald Trump tweeting Wednesday, vowing not to rename military bases named after Confederate military figures. The White House also weighing its own executive order on police reform, separate from lawmakers' own efforts. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
Thursday, President Donald Trump issued an executive order authorizing U.S. sanctions against International Criminal Court personnel involved in an investigation into whether some American forces committed war crimes in Afghanistan. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the Hague-based court is politically motivated and a threat to U.S. sovereignty. VOA diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has the details.
U.S. military personnel and intelligence operatives have been fighting against terrorism in Afghanistan for the past 18 years. The operations have led to about 700 complaints of war crimes from alleged victims in the country. The International Criminal Court, or ICC, has authorized a major probe, the first time the court's prosecutor has been cleared to investigate American forces.
We cannot, we will not stand by as our people are threatened by a kangaroo court. And indeed, I have a message to many close allies around the world. Your people could be next.
On Thursday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced U.S. economic sanctions and travel restrictions on ICC personnel involved in the probe. The move to target the ICC has been condemned by human rights groups.
One of the most troubling elements of this executive action is that you have the Trump administration deploying tools that are typically used for some of the most dangerous threats to the United States and to people everywhere.
Paulson explained what the ICC is investigating.
The proposed investigation specifically targets war crimes, serious war crimes that were committed in Afghanistan, on the territory of Afghanistan, by all parties to the conflict. Now, obviously, the United States is one of many parties to the conflict, but that also includes the Taliban, that includes Afghan government-aligned forces. So the Trump administration's claim simply amounts to a request for impunity for one party.
The United States is not a party to the Rome Statute that created the ICC and has never accepted its authority over its personnel, Defense Secretary Mark Esper said.
That is why our nation and this administration will not allow American citizens who have served our country to be subjected to illegitimate investigations. Instead, we expect information about alleged misconduct by our people to be turned over to U.S. authorities, so that we could take the appropriate action as we have consistently done so in the past.
Many U.S. lawmakers from both parties have vocally opposed ICC investigations of the U.S. and its ally, Israel. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was quick to praise President Donald Trump for the sanctions. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
And coming up later...
And then we fell in love, okay? No, really. He wrote me beautiful letters.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Disturbances on the sun have the potential to wreak havoc with Earth's power grids and communication equipment. A new study by biologists at Duke University in North Carolina and an astronomer from the Adler Planetarium in Chicago suggests that solar storms could also mix up the navigational abilities of whales, causing them to be stranded or beached on land. Scientists have found that some animal species can detect Earth's magnetic field and use it as a kind of GPS to navigate their migrations. The study's authors say that solar storms could be disrupting signals from that magnetic field. They suspect radio frequency noise created when high-energy solar particles smack into the magnetic field could be overpowering the whale's senses. It would be like turning off their GPS during the middle of their journey. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A report by the United Nations University says the economic fallout from the global pandemic could plunge 395 million people into conditions in which they are forced to live on $1.90 a day or less. That's the definition of extreme poverty. However, a separate World Bank report this week put that number between 70 and 100 million people. The UN report says South Asia and India in particular will see the largest number of people sinking into extreme poverty, followed by sub-Saharan Africa. Experts are appealing to economically powerful nations to forgive the debts of developing countries that are taking strong hits from the pandemic. In addition, a U.S. biotechnology company says it will make the first widespread tests of a possible coronavirus vaccine next month. A Johns Hopkins University tracker puts the total number of confirmed COVID-19 cases worldwide at over 7.5 million, of which the United States has over 2 million cases alone. We do have additional information about the pandemic on our website. That address, voanews.com. A joint report by the International Labor Organization and the UN Children's Fund warns millions of children are likely to be pushed into forced labor because of the economic fallout from the COVID-19 pandemic. Lisa Schlein has that story.
Authors of the report warn the global pandemic is likely to reverse decades of steady progress made in reducing the number of child laborers. Over the past 20 years, the International Labor Organization says child labor has decreased by 94 million. The latest figures put the number of child laborers globally at 152 million, nearly half of them in what is called hazardous child labor. Those jobs are particularly dangerous and hazardous to the physical and mental well-being of children. They include work in the agriculture, mining, construction, manufacturing, and domestic sectors. The report warns millions of children are likely to be forced into the worst forms of labor as COVID-19 wreaks havoc on the economy and families have no means of support. COVID-19 is the disease caused by the coronavirus. The senior researcher and ILO lead author of the report, Lorenzo Guarcello, tells VOA evidence is growing that child labor is rising as schools close during the pandemic. He says many children who do not go to school are likely to be forced into exploitative and hazardous jobs.
Families are sending children to sell in the street some food, flowers, so... Already they are starting to work. They are much more exposed to work in hazardous conditions because of the increase, the likely increase of involvement in the informal sector.
Guarcello says Africa has the largest number of child laborers. Of the 72 million child laborers, he says 31.5 million are in hazardous work. He says most are employed in the agriculture sector.
We know that working in agriculture exposes children to hazardous conditions, working long hours, being exposed to the heat for the full day, using dangerous machinery, and so on.
Guarcello says the ILO and UNICEF are developing a simulation model to look at the global impact of COVID-19 on child labor. He says new global estimates will be released next year. Among its recommendations, the joint report is calling for comprehensive social protection and easier access to credit for poor households to counter the threat of child labor. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Protesters gathered at a shopping center in Hong Kong Friday to demonstrate against China's plans to impose a new national security law on the territory that was passed 2 weeks ago in the National People's Congress. China is expected to enforce the new security law in Hong Kong by the end of the summer, if not sooner. Critics say it would undermine the joint declaration which returned the former British colony to China in 1997 under the framework of one country, two systems. Rights groups and lawmakers are calling on Cambodian authorities to carry out a thorough and transparent investigation into the possible kidnapping of a Thai dissident in the capital last week. 8 other Thai dissidents in exile have gone missing in Laos and Vietnam since the coup of 2014. 2 of them were later found dead in the Mekong River. The United States and Iraq have affirmed their commitment to cutting the number of U.S. troops in Iraq without giving a timeline. In a joint statement on the U.S.-Iraq strategic dialogue issued on Thursday, the two countries recognized the progress made in eliminating the Islamic State threat, which allows the U.S. to continue to reduce its forces in Iraq over the coming months. It was on this day in 2018 when U.S. President Donald Trump held his first face-to-face meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Singapore. The meeting, as many described it, was unprecedented. Now, speaking to his reporters at a rally a few months after that event, President Trump recounted his experience.
I was really being tough, and so was he. And we would go back and forth, and then we fell in love. Okay? No, really. He wrote me beautiful letters, and they're great letters. We fell in love.
But now, North Korean state media is singing another tune. Reuters' Libby Hogan takes things from here.
North Korea says it sees little use in Kim Jong-un keeping up ties with U.S. President Donald Trump. State media broadcast that statement Friday, the 2-year anniversary of the leaders' first summit in Singapore. It said if Washington sticks to, quote, hostile policies, the relationship was unlikely to lead to a diplomatic breakthrough. It added that North Korea would develop more military forces as, quote, U.S. policies prove Washington remains a long-term threat to the North Korean state. Trump and Kim Jong-un have a history of exchanging insults and threats. In 2017, North Korea made large advances in its nuclear and missile program. The U.S. hit back and led an international effort to tighten sanctions, targeting its shipping industry and companies that do business abroad. The Singapore summit saw relations seemingly turn a corner when Trump and Kim walked in a garden together in images broadcast around the world. There were a lot of handshakes and it all ended in 4 vague commitments and a meeting Trump touted as
honest, direct and productive.
But a year later in Vietnam, they failed to reach a concrete deal. Earlier in the week, North Korea also criticized the United States for commenting on affairs between the Koreas and said Washington should stay quiet if it wants this year's presidential elections to go smoothly. The U.S. State Department and the White House did not immediately respond to requests for comment.
That was Reuters reporter Libby Hogan. Amid physically distancing during the COVID-19 pandemic, the developed world has seen a mammoth spike in the use of Zoom and other online video conferencing tools to telework, conduct business, do telemedicine and therapy, as well as meet up with also isolated loved ones, friends, and others. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Sherry Turkle, the Abby Rockefeller Mauser Professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology via Zoom. She recalled that she was professionally intrigued to see that many of her students now prefer communicating via text rather than face-to-face.
And I started to interview them about it, and it was clear that it made them feel less vulnerable.
How so?
You never know what the other person is going to say, and you have to make it up in real time.
If you put it that way, in-person communication does seem a bit more stressful.
That's true. But talking face-to-face also means you can make eye contact, you can take in the full body and gestures and voice. You pick up so many cues about what's really going on.
So how does Zoom compare with what you learned about texts? You're face-to-face in a sense, but it's still on a computer.
Well, I've been doing some interesting studies that show that for some purposes, you really are better off with a telephone call. The focused attention that you can give a voice is better than Zoom. That's why radio hasn't disappeared. Now, for teaching, for meetings, when partners and families can't be together, I think Zoom is very good for that. And, you know, clearly people are doing very creative things with Zoom. I'm teaching on Zoom and I'm working very hard to make those classes exciting. But I'm looking at 30 little postage stamp faces. And if you're just seeing me on a screen with a fake background, it's not natural.
So face-to-face is more natural, in your opinion, because there's more human emotional information in it.
Part of what we say when we say face-to-face is we really mean body-to-body. How does a mother know their child is anxious? Through so many dimensions of how their muscles and neck are sitting, how their forehead is sitting. And in Zoom, you never are looking at the person's eyes. You know, I don't want to sound churlish or, you know, negative, because I'm grateful to this technology. Were it not for this technology, I would not be able to teach my classes. I think my classes this semester have been extraordinary for me, have given me a deep insight into the experience of my students, which has been very difficult. And I think we're all very sustained together in these classes. But here's what I worry about. I worry that there are going to be a lot of businesses and a lot of small universities and a lot of enterprises that are going to say, you know what? It's really cheaper to do all this on Zoom. So after all, it probably did 60% of what we need, and 60% is good enough for us. And I worry that we're going to be losing the wrong 40% of what we need as educators, of what we need as healers, as what we need as people.
So you would advise against using Zoom in most cases?
Well, it depends what our purpose is. All technology depends on what you want to use it for. So if the purpose is setting me up to do an interview, let's say it accomplishes its purpose. But if the purpose was writing a significant article about me that really captures my essence in some way, I would say you should spend an afternoon with me and have a meal with me. We want to be most human to each other. So it's a complicated thing that's going on now. And I think that really what's important to keep in mind is, what are your human purposes? This is my big message in all my works. If you're a therapist and your patients have gotten so used to doing things online that they're telling you that they don't want to come in, well, that could be more convenient for me. I can start seeing patients all over the world, basically. But is this really serving the human purpose of my really being the most intimate therapist or doctor that I could be? Or all this telemedicine, am I being the best doctor I could be if I can't lay on hands? So I think the big question is not what it's like to be in quarantine in these very extraordinary times. I'm saying that let's be very careful as we move ahead what we do with this experience.
Sherry Turkle teaches at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She was speaking with our own Adam Phillips. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.